All right, just checking those online. You can hear me okay? All right, great. All right, welcome to everyone here in person. Nice to see everyone, and welcome to anyone who might be visiting us for the first time tonight. So we'll begin with our meditation and then go into a little talk about these oxygen pictures. So this month's verse, Catching the Ox. I seize it with a terrific struggle. Its great will and power are inexhaustible. It charges to the high plateau far above the cloud mists, or in an impenetrable ravine it stands. All right, we'll come back in 5 minutes at 7:45 for the talk. All right, welcome back. Nice to see everyone. And just for those who are both here and also online, just a quick word about masks. So we have the policy is basically it's open to your choice. So people can wear masks if they feel more comfortable, and people can not if they feel more comfortable. So just to respect each person's choice around that. All right, so we are starting a new month on this next picture of the oxfording, especially around this idea of trying to catch the ox. Now, the ox herding pictures, for those who are just new to this, is a depiction of the spiritual path from a Zen tradition. So it's a series of 10 pictures that really show this progression or evolution, if you will, of our practice. And I think we don't have the picture available, but let me, it's basically a small person struggling with this big, massive ox. You can look on our website to see the picture. But I'll read the verse again. So, catching the ox. I seize it with a terrific struggle. Its great will and power are inexhaustible. It charges to the high plateau far above the cloud mists, or in an impenetrable ravine it stands. So you get this sense that this image here really has a lot of energy to it, a lot of struggle, a lot of, you know, trying to tame this wild beast. In fact, let's look at these pictures for a moment just from their face value. If we just looked at them, if we don't know what they were about, we would see the first picture is someone searching for this wild animal, searching here and there, not very successfully. The second picture, the person starts to see traces, sees footsteps of this great beast. And it's, you know, getting a little more interested and excited to find where that beast lies. And then the third picture from last month, we actually see the ox. We see the bull. These translations we're using uses bull instead of ox often. But it's the same thing, bull, ox. So you see it. You know, it's like, imagine going through the woods and you suddenly see that beast or that animal that you've been searching for, that you've been trying to find. It suddenly appears, right? So that's kind of a really special moment. And then we decide, okay, we want to catch it. We want to actually somehow put a rope around it. And then once we've caught it, then we can tame it, and then we can start to join together. We can have it follow us along and do what we want it to do. So that's all makes sense until like the seventh picture, when the ox is forgotten. And that's very surprising that suddenly this thing that we've been focusing on so much, we forget about it. So that's where it starts to point toward that these pictures aren't just about an instruction manual on how to find and capture a wild beast. You know, it's really pointing towards something much deeper, really our spiritual practice. So it's really a metaphor of this spiritual journey that, you know, it may not unfold in this particular linear way. And it often, for many of us, it's kind of like a helical process that we might have. One day we might be searching for the ox. The next day we might be trying to tame it. The next day we're just seeing it. The next day we're writing at home. Or even throughout a meditation period, it can kind of go through that. But also, if you look at our practice over the years, there's often moments of insight that start to transform us in a way that these pictures resonate in different ways and in deeper ways. So wherever we are in our practice, whether we're just starting or we have decades under our belt, you know, Tuori and I thought this exploration would be very helpful as a way to kind of contrast our normal insight or Vipassana practice. So what does the ox really represent? You know, particularly in this image here of trying to catch the ox. So it represents our true nature, you know, what we are underneath all our conditioning, all our projections, all our identification. It really points to this, the almost wordless quality, the wonder of our true nature. So it's a lot of spiritual traditions try to point toward that, try to provide pathways to discover that, to learn how to recognize it and how to nourish it and how to really embody it. And Buddhism is no different. So it's interesting, though, when you hold that the ox represents our true nature and what we really are, and yet the ox is portrayed as being outside of us. It's something that we're trying to find, we're trying to track, we're trying to see, we're trying to catch, trying to tame. Because this true nature is, even though it's really inherently what we are, it's not really outside of us. It's actually covered up. It's obscured. It's forgotten. And we don't have as much access to it. We get distracted by life. We get distracted by our worries, our fantasies. We've lost contact with this true nature. So this ox herding series is really about how do you rediscover that true nature? How do you reconnect with it? So we start with that first picture, you know, searching outside of ourselves for that ox. Of course, the irony is this is really inside of us, and yet we're searching for something which is outside. We perceive it as being outside of where we are. It's like if you ever try to find your glasses and you're looking everywhere and you finally realize they're right on your nose. You know, it's like I think we've all experienced that, or maybe our friends or our loved ones have had that. And so it's a little bit of that inside joke that we're searching for something, and we're striving so hard to find it. Then we start to see traces of it. We start to get a hint of that. And sometimes this might be just, you know, you start to find a growing sensitivity in your heart through Dharma practice or other ways. And you start to see, you know, maybe nature starts to resonate in a certain way. It touches something in you that feels more profound. You can even say sacred, something that is beyond your normal way of seeing. Or perhaps you see a beautiful sculpture or a painting, or you hear a poem or a piece of music that moves you in a way. It touches something in you. It's like seeing the traces of the ox. Or in our Dharma practice, we start to get a sense of where that peace is, that sense of stillness, and that sense of clarity of mind. And then finally, we see the ox, as in last month, glimpsing that true nature, what we truly are. And it's really a special moment of realization. We see that, okay, really cease. There's something that, again, it's we're seeing something outside of ourselves, but there's some, almost what's truly inside of us starts to recognize that. It's like the self, the true self seeing itself, let's say. And there's that peace, that tranquility, that release of effort that we explored last month in that seeing the ox picture. Right? So then from there, we go into this picture of trying to tame this ox. Actually, first trying to catch it. Taming is next month. So why are we trying to catch it? You know, how are we supposed to catch something that's already inside of us? You know, and yet we do that as practitioners, because our true nature is a bit untamed at this point. You know, it goes where it will. Sometimes it's present, sometimes it's very embodied, and sometimes it seems so far away. That's what I meant by we can kind of switch back and forth between these pictures. We can see the ox, we can be, you know, have our hands on it, and then the next moment, it's gone. We're like, where is that ox? Where has it gone? This verse points to that. I seize it with terrific strength, struggle, its great will and power are inexhaustible. And it charges into the high plateau far above the cloud mists, or into an impenetrable ravine it stands. So it's very fleeting at this point that we see it and suddenly it's gone. We're grappling with it and suddenly it's gone. So we want to catch it. We want to keep contact with our true nature. We want to control it and tame it so it goes where we want. We want to have mastery of that. Now, the words I just said, that we want to control it and tame it, have mastery. I mean, hopefully that those words feel a little off to you, and I can intentionally set them that way, because this picture is showing that trying to exert control of something that really isn't inherently separate from us. Right? So we're trying to find something, we're trying to catch it and eventually tame it, but it's actually something it's always right here. It's just so covered up. It's so obscured. Another way to say that is these first six pictures really point toward the nature of our divided heart. A divided heart, when we look out and see that sense of separation, of isolation, of self and other. It can be very benign. It's like, I see something I really like and appreciate. I can see our dear friend and have that sense of affection and love for them. And yet there's still that separation. Other side of the spectrum is hatred, is prejudice, is all the ways that we make the other something that needs to be kept down or destroyed or removed. So this is the nature of that divided heart, the seeing of duality, of separation. So these first six pictures, and this is what picture the fourth one in this series. So it's really coming from this perspective of separation, and that's how we, most of us, if not all of us, start our practice. Because that's kind of baked into us. We learn how to be separate. And we start off, of course, unified with our mothers. There's no separation. Then we start to become, I'm this way. I'm separate from my parents. And then there's that sense of becoming autonomous. And then, you know, as our practice or as our life matures, we may turn back into rediscovering that interconnection. So these first pictures have that as a kind of built-in strategy. How do we practice from that place of separation? That's how we have to start. So there's nothing wrong with it. You're just trying to understand it. And these pictures also show eventually the end of that strategy. So we're trying to find, catch, and conquer something which we think is apart from us, separate from us. But actually it is not. And that's what these last four pictures explore, the release of that concept of separation. So it was interesting kind of working on this talk and how I'm exploring it tonight anyway, is that seeing of something that's inherently us, our inner nature, and how we see it as being separate from us, and we're trying to struggle with it, trying to bring it in. So this is seeing separation when there's actually not separation. You're seeing our true nature or something outside of ourselves is really an expression of what we would call in Buddhism delusion or ignorance, or an essential sense of blindness, of misunderstanding of how the nature of how things actually are. So these pictures of the ox, the way I'm looking at it tonight, is the ox itself is this mixture of it's our true nature, but also has a healthy helping of our delusion mixed with it. That's why it's obscured. That's why we're struggling with it. That's why we're trying to catch it and control it. Because it's our wisdom is there, the true nature is there, but also our ignorance, our delusion, our basic not seeing how things actually are is in that. So this delusion, you know, this it's an interesting word in our culture, but it's really meaning it's not like you're delusional, but you're really not seeing things clearly. You're not seeing how things actually are. This is a very powerful aspect of our lives. It's really a powerful piece that we're always working with as Dharma practitioners is also sneaky. For those of you who remember the Buddha's story of awakening, he, on his night of awakening, he, of course, had this deep resolve to awaken no matter what. And Mara, who's kind of the personification of delusion, came in to question him, to fight him, to try to convince him not to go that path. And we throw out basically the hindrances, throw out sense desire and fear and anger, confusion. And each time the Buddha was able to reconnect with how things actually are through his wisdom. And eventually he was able to see through that and awoken. But even years later, the Buddha would be practicing and going about his life as a monk. And Mara would show up and try to trick him again, or try to confuse him, try to throw out these hindrances. Because when I saw that in the suttas, I thought, oh, that's actually reassuring. Because even the Buddha, after his awakening, you think, okay, he's done. He doesn't ever have to deal with that stuff again. Right? But no, his mind would still get reactive. This doesn't say in the suttas. I'm kind of reading into it. But I think that's how they kind of mythologized it, that Mara would show up and try to trick the Buddha. But really, Mara is just a externalization of our own personal delusion and the power of that. And so eventually the Buddha would see through that and say, okay, I see you, Mara. And then Mara would walk away disgruntled, disappointed that he could not trick the Buddha. And so remember that, you know, have patience with your own struggle, your own reactivity, that it has a lot of momentum. I think this is where this picture really points to that element of struggle with our delusion. How do we work skillfully? How do we apply skillful effort in relationship to our delusion? Apply effort in a way that allows a deepening of our practice. This is really much of our practice. We practice toward wisdom through our delusion. This is really the release of struggle and struggle itself. As our practice is really working on this edge, this leading edge of our wisdom and delusion. And if we're really practicing, in a fruitful way, we're always kind of right on that edge of what is seen, what is known, and what is unknown. And we're always kind of sensing, oh, wow, there's that unskillful word I just said, that unskillful email I sent, the anger that came out, the fear I came out, the gossip, all those things. If we look at that, when we see that, instead of judging ourselves for actually having that reaction, we realize, oh, this is me acting from separation. This is me acting from pain. And when I learn to reorient that and bring compassion to that pain, then we're really working on that leading edge. We're slowly dissolving this wall of delusion, the edge of our growth. Now, on the other hand, sometimes we stay a little too comfortable in our practice. And this is where this picture kind of should bring energy to our practice. Okay, really, you know, how am I going to catch that ox? Because if we just completely relax and just say, okay, I'm not going to do anything, delusion often has a way of just kind of sweeping us down the current. We find ourselves following those mind trains, those thoughts of judgment, comparison, fantasy, and we really just kind of keep doing the same thing. Even if we're practicing, we may practice every day, but we're kind of finding a way to just practice in a way that feels very comfortable. It feels very familiar. I think that's the key piece, the familiar comfort of our practice. So I'll encourage you, if that resonates with you, is to kind of look at how am I relating to my delusion? Am I actually moving toward that edge? There's studies around mastery. So it's a little aside, but it's also not so much of an aside. Because we are trying to learn to master our practice. We're learning to master our minds, how to really master the art of seeing clearly. This is really these series of pictures of catching the ox, taming the ox, riding the home the ox, is all around this process of mastery. Right? So what does that mean? As many of you know that they've talked about 10 years of effort towards something. You know, you become a master, an expert. Some people say 10,000 hours. But the definition I really prefer is it's a sustained working just beyond your competency, just beyond your what you're competent in. If you're constantly doing that working, if you work too much FOSTA, you get discouraged. The failure becomes too strong. But if you're just working right on that edge, then you're actually growing in an optimum way. If you do that for a sustained thing, like I've played guitar for probably over 25 years, but I'm not a master at it because I don't always work on that edge. Sometimes I do, but usually I don't. I often stay where it's comfortable. But other areas in my life, I have worked that edge. So there's a deepening of that, being more masterful of that. And same thing with our Dharma practice. And we'll talk a little bit more about what that edge is really about, that edge of mastery, but really points toward, are we practicing in a way that's reinforcing the sense of me? Or am I practicing in a way that allows me to understand that sense of me, that sense of identification? Are we practicing in a way, we can be struggling in a way that perpetuates our suffering? Or we can perpetuate, you know, practice in a way that actually, even though we might be struggling, we're actually starting to release that. So that's really the heart of it. There's a poem that Kerry Peterson shared and made a talk all about, actually, back when we were at Center for Spiritual Living for that period of time. I guess that's probably 7 years ago now. It's another Zen poem. But it points to this. It says, it's called No Water, No Moon. When this nun, Chiyono, studied Zen under Bhikkhu of Engaku, she was unable to attain the fruits of meditation for a long time. Alas, one moonlight night, she was carrying water in an old pail bound with bamboo. The bamboo broke and the bottom fell out of the pail. And at that moment, Chiyono was set free. In commemoration, she wrote a poem. In this way and that, I tried to save the old pail. Since the bamboo strip was weakened and about to break, until at last the bottom fell out. No more water in pail. No more moon in water. So this poem ties right back into what I was saying. That This nun practiced for so many years trying to save the old pail, to patch it up, to, you know, tie it together so it wouldn't fall apart. That's just practicing in a way that's reinforcing that sense of me, reinforcing that delusion. Until finally something shifted and she released that. I sometimes struggle, I touched on this last week, comes from that glimpse of the ox. I mean, how many reflect, I bet this is almost 100% of us. How many of you have noticed that when you've been practicing and you get this moment of sublime stillness or quiet or peace, and just something clicks and suddenly the meditation is doing itself, or there's a sense of deep fulfillment, there's a sense of ease, there's a sense of non-effort. And you say, that's it. That's what I've been looking for. Right? That's seeing the ox. And what happens after that for most of us? The next sittings, are they nice and calm like that? Or are we trying to get back to that state? Are we trying to find that ox again? We set up a sense of struggle to find something and we just cause more and more suffering. So see, that's why I like to encourage us to always not only practice with whatever intention we have or object, but also notice how we're practicing, what the mind attitude we have with that. Like Uttejaniya speaks of what's the wise attitude in meditation. To notice, are we trying to get someplace? Are we trying to achieve something? Because that actually makes it go further away, right? So again, you can see this is paradoxical because I just talked about the importance of working in your edge, right? But yet it's like there's a way that we can work toward an edge, but we're kind of feeling like ourselves becoming less personally invested. We've come, there's a thinning of our, really of our ego, of our identification. Or we could practice in a way that reinforces that, makes it stronger. So this is part of this image here, this exploration that I encourage us to look at. Because we can practice in a way that's reinforcing craving, that trying to get back to something, judging the moment that lacks what we're seeking, judging the person who's lacking it. If only I was a better meditator, then I would finally get back to that state. We're really reinforcing that sense of me. Or am I investigating in a way, if I'm seeing that edge of delusion, that edge of identification, that edge of where I take myself to be who I am. Another way to say it is we're investigating that edge of what's known and what's unknown. When I say known, it's like when I look at someone or something and I have my ideas come up around it, my images, my reactivity, that's fixing life in a known place. If I stay in that fixation, it's just, I'm not going to deepen very much. But if I'm willing to go into, actually, let me listen more fully. Let me drop my preconceptions. Let me actually see what is right in front of me with a freshness of eyes without assumptions, and really to be fully present for it. That's releasing that edge. That's working on that edge. So this is the, we learn this through trial and error. We practice, we find ourselves losing the ox, finding the ox, glimpsing the ox, trying to catch the ox. As this picture points toward that the ox, we can grab hold of it with a lot of effort, and then suddenly it charges to the high plateau, far above the cloud mist, out of reach, or it goes into an impenetrable ravine. It stands. You can see it, but it's so far away. There's no way we can get to it. Right? So this is also a picture of that discouragement, of that struggle. So really trying to free this ox from our delusion. Trying to see if it represents our true nature, but it also represents our delusion. That's what it kind of makes the ox make its horns and its muscles and its bones. So seizing it with a terrific struggle. So this battle and struggle with the forces of delusion really it's our own personal struggle that we all have to walk if we choose to. If we really are drawn to this path, there is that meeting of that struggle with that. We can see it in our daily meditations. We can see it when we go on retreats. But we can also see it in our lives as we try to apply our practice to our lives, how we understand it. So it has a very personal manifestation for us. And it's also a universal process. That's why it's often portrayed in these archetypes, these big ways of explaining it. These ox herding pictures are an archetype of that process. And delusion is often portrayed externally, as I mentioned, with Mara, with this externalized god of delusion. Or if you have a different tradition, like if you're Christian, it can be as the devil, could be a way that's portrayed. You can see a parallel to when Jesus goes into the desert for 40 days and struggles with the devil. It's like it's very parallel to this whole process that the Buddha went through. And we externalize something like that, make it, you know, okay, let's put it out there. We can actually see it in this archetypal or mythological way. And that reaches a part of our psyche that we may not have access to otherwise. And also highlights this common experience as human beings. And just to read, talking about this struggle, reading a section from the suttas, the early teachings of the Buddha with his, we often think of the Buddha, we have these images of him, you know, sitting very peacefully, very tranquilly, you know, with this kind of just very slight smile. But he practiced very diligently. He had a tremendous amount of effort and really striving. So the Buddha began practicing in an extreme way, as was common with ascetics in that time period. So he thought, I'm going to quote him now, "I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush my mind with my mind. Crush my mind with my mind. Then, as a strong man might seize a weaker by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed my mind with my mind. Sweat ran from my armpits while I did so. Though tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness established, yet my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful effort. But such painful feelings as arose in me gained no power over my mind." So the Buddha, before he became the Buddha, he went through this period of really striving, of really trying to catch that ox, and really struggling with the ox, with all the effort he could bring. And eventually he realized that it was not the right way to practice. I think I mentioned a few, I don't know, was this last month perhaps, maybe the month before, the rose apple tree, when he had this vision of himself as a young child sitting relaxed in the sunshine with the shade of the tree, looking across this expansive field, seeing his father plowing the field. And he felt himself his mind just became very balanced, very still, very concentrated, without effort. He was wondering, when he was almost dead through this effort, and he was starving himself, that maybe that's the way to go. But the paradox is his effort allowed him to see that more clearly. And so some of us are stubborn. We have to almost exhaust the capacities of our effort to see its limitation. But even while we're practicing, if we're practicing again in a skillful way, we're constantly starting to see more and more clearly the nature of self, of isolation, the nature of suffering, the nature of separation. So this is kind of the big archetypes of the Buddhist tradition. And I think it's also in the Christian tradition, perhaps not emphasized in the same way. But we can also look at this in a very immediate way. In a very immediate way in how we actually practice to develop concentration, steadiness. That's why in the meditation, I intentionally directed you toward a little bit more pointed focus. Okay, just focus just on your breath. Release everything else, just to kind of elicit that quality of effort and maybe a little bit of struggle. Because did anyone have any trouble with their minds wandering? Right? So when your minds wander, that's part of trying to catch the ox. It's like I'm trying to come back to the breath, and my mind keeps wandering. That's the wildness of the ox, of that kind of delusional wisdom thing we call the ox. It keeps pulling us into our fantasy, into our worry, into our whatever might be going through the mind, the to-do list. Okay, so that's a very tangible way that this picture shows up. Right? So how do we work with that? How do we bring the right kind of effort? Right effort is wise effort that actually leads to loosening our suffering. Effort that leads to starting to release our heart. So I remember in my early days, I think particularly the first 6 months or a year of meditation, you know, my mind just felt so busy with thoughts. And I think as many people notice, when you start to meditate, you actually see you're a little bit shocked by how busy your mind really is. Because before you meditate, you think, oh, my mind's pretty quiet, or, you know, it's chatting a bit. But when you actually try to focus on something like the breath, by contrast, you see how often your mind just goes this way and that way. How often that ox just goes wherever it wants. And you say, come back here, right? A technique that I used quite a bit in those early days, I learned from a teacher named Shinzen Young. And it was as a variation of a noting technique. So I'll share that just if it's helpful in those times. So noting comes from a Mahasi style of meditation, where you note every moment's experience, breathing in, breathing out. Different traditions use that. But you can also note, you know, stepping. You can note, you know, raising your hand. And what Chusen Yung added to this was actually note, he used the concept of like gears in a car. I love this analogy because it's very down to earth, right? So if you imagine you had a four-wheel drive car and you were driving along and got stuck in the mud. Okay. If you try to go to fifth gear, your wheels are just going to spin. Okay. So the mud is your mind being really distracted, being really lost in thought. No contact with the breath, right? The contact is when you actually start to make traction forward. So you say, okay, put it down in four-wheel drive and note out loud. Okay. So this is obviously you do something when you're at home and you're not going to disturb other people. But I found that was really helpful. Like I started breathing in, breathing out. And that way I had the feedback whether I was actually present or not. And it felt like I was really trying to go against this. Sometimes it felt like a blizzard, just like so many thoughts going this way. And I would maybe feel half a breath and be lost in thought, and come back. And it took a lot of perseverance, a lot of effort and work to try to learn to come back. So at that point, I was really practicing with a fair amount of self-judgment and, you know, tension when I was doing it. You know, my delusion was much higher than it is now. But that's the strategy that I used. And so go on with his technique for a moment that you would, once you started to get out of the mud, then you would maybe drop the out loud noting. And then eventually you could just drop noting altogether. So it's a very powerful technique to help us come back. But, you know, for my own practice and the way I teach, I don't tend to say I use it as a skillful means, not as in and of itself. Well, look, the Mahasi technique really uses that as a whole technique you use all the way through. So learning how to find that ox, to find that catching that moment, you know, it's, we all have to do that. We go on retreats. You know, sometimes the first couple of days, our minds are very tired, very distracted. We basically have the momentum of our life kind of, that's what we're still carrying in. We're sitting with our normal minds. And after a few days, we start to settle down. We start to develop more concentration. But even in the middle of the retreat, you can have these kind of storms of distraction and minds going all over the place. That's when the ox is off in the mists, down in the ravine. You know it's there, but you can't get to it. Right? The difference is the more we practice, the more we learn to see the ox coming and going, we start to have confidence that the ox will come back, that we can actually, and we learn to practice in a more skillful way, a more gentle way. It often feels for many people much more as a gentleness that comes in, a self-kindness comes into how we practice. So unlike the Buddha basically torturing himself through his effort, you know, this again was before he really realized and awoken. We have the benefit of that awakening and how we practice today. So we can practice that sense of kindness, a sense of compassion. And realizing, okay, my mind's distracted. If I tighten up and judge myself around that, that just injects a bunch of tension into the practice. So, oh, the mind's doing its thing again. Let's gently come back. So you start to have more and more confidence in doing less, paradoxically. You have more confidence in that, okay, if I relax into the moment, that seems to be what allows that ox to arise. And the same thing with our daily life. As we try to apply our growing wisdom and compassion to our relationships, to our work, to our families, you know, how do we bring that forth? And it's a really an alive practice. It's a very intense practice if you bring it into those areas. Like, how do I, when I feel that reactivity toward my daughter for not going to sleep in time, or you know, procrastination. You know, how do I meet that? How do I own my own experience? And how do I find a way to communicate that's respectful of her, respectful of myself. So practice, it has such a paradox, because if we don't are not willing to bring effort and struggle to it, the willingness to struggle, our practice won't deepen. We'll be just swept away by that delusion. But yet if we practice in a way that's unskillful, we can actually reinforce it. And so this picture really brings us right to that crux, if you will, of wise effort, of wise struggle. And how do we catch that ox? How do we actually get a hold of it? And also, how do we catch it in a way that doesn't turn into perpetuating our suffering? And just to touch upon, to finish with that poem again, from that Zen nun around this pail that we often, this is the pail of self-identification, the pail of taking self, of I, of me and mine. No water, no moon. When the nun Chiono studied Zen under Buko of Engaku, she was unable to attain the fruits of meditation for a long time. At last, one moonlit night, she was carrying water in an old pail bound with bamboo. The bamboo broke and the bottom fell out of the pail, and at that moment, Chiono was set free. In commemoration, she wrote a poem. In this way and that, I tried to save the old pail. Since the bamboo strip was weakening and about to break, until at last the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail. No more moon in the water. All right, just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle. So reflect on the benefit of struggle, on the effort in your practice, an effort in your practice. Okay, so just reflect on that. If you don't have any effort, or you're not willing to kind of struggle when your mind is really distracted, how does your practice actually deepen? You know, if you're practicing and you don't feel like it and you just get up, you know, does the practice really deepen in that way? Or are you willing to practice? Okay, I just don't feel like practicing, but I'm going to sit here for my intended time. That's where that's really that edge of trying to catch that ox shows up. How does it help wisdom grow and delusion fade? In what ways do you struggle unwisely in a way that perpetuates suffering? And how can we discern that difference? Okay, so this is really an alive question for you, because the exact same behavior, the exact same action may be coming from a very wise place or a very deluded place. You have to really kind of notice that. So it's an active question to bring up. And what's really wise effort? What's wise way of practicing? What's the role of struggle in a way that benefits our practice? And where is struggle in a way that perpetuates our suffering? All right, so I hope you enjoy that exploration. And now we have a chance for any sharing or questions you might have. So let's see if there's anyone here in the room who would like to share. Yes, do you mind getting the mics? Let me shift so you can see her online.
Hi, I'm Amy. Can you hear me? Is that on?
Okay.
Yeah, they can hear you. It doesn't come out of the speaker.
Oh, okay, can you guys hear her okay? Okay, go ahead, Amy.
I think one of the things about the struggle that comes up for me is that it's a way for me to kind of be humble and practice humility, because I feel when I see my mind going all over the place, like it's just, I don't know, I guess it's just that I get to see my imperfections well, which I think helps me be a better person in the world, you know, because I think it's always easy to see other people's imperfections and, you know, and I think meditation gives us a chance to see our own, you know. So for me, that's something I'm grateful for.
Great. Thank you, Amy. Yeah, that's a great reflection that, you know, meditation helps us see our minds much more clearly. And if we're able to see it like with a sense of humor, of humility, of just okay, this is just my mind going all over the place. Remember Joseph Goldstein talked about, you know, people often project a lot on a senior teacher like that. But he said, if I was able to project the contents of my mind on a screen like this, nobody would come and listen to me, right? And so it's like we start to realize, okay, my mind's just going all over the place. And yet, you know, we start to realize, okay, maybe it's, I'm not who or what I am, is it in where those, the mind goes, there's something else, you know, that we start to have more and more, that's really seeing more clearly where the ox is, it's our true nature. And that sense of, you know, sometimes that just naturally comes, that sense of, okay, matter of factness around it, or humility around how our minds go. And sometimes we really have to go through the process of kind of trying to stop that, trying to control our minds. And until we finally, just by exhaustion, we just give up and say, okay. And realize, oh, okay, it's just an attitude shift, really, that, oh, if I don't make a big deal what my mind does, it's not a big deal. If I make a big deal of it, then I'm going to be struggling a lot. And I think for many of us, we have to kind of find that, find our way through that. So thank you for pointing that out, Amy. All right, how about online? Anyone like to share anything? Share or ask? Okay, Amber, go ahead.
Thank you for your talk. I thought it was really helpful. I'm curious about, and this is kind of just a broad question that I've been wondering about in the past, but two questions, I think, at the same time. One is about the idea of delusion and the separate self. And on what level are we thinking of things in the absolute plane and versus the relative? And how do we use those skillfully so that we can retain an ability to have separate self and boundaries and things like this in our different relationships while also having the absolute sense of the truth of the way things are? That's one question. And then also about Mara and those final moments of the Buddha's enlightenment journey. And what do you think about the idea of needing to incorporate or integrate kind of splintered off parts of ourself, and that we are seeing in an externalized form, or we're seeing as greed, anger, hatred, delusion, but they're really parts that are kind of wounded aspects of ourself. So those are just things that I was curious about.
All right. Thank you, Amber. Yeah, we could do a whole talk on both of those. So the first one was, I just lost it. What was it? Oh, the sense of got it. So absolute self versus relative self, you know, where do those play together? How do we work with those? So Christina Feldman was teaching here and said it in this way, which I thought was very helpful, that there's the navigational self that we still retain. That's the self that knows how to do our job. It knows how to have boundaries. It knows how to navigate literally through the world. Right? Because if we have completely unformed, we won't know where to go, what to do, how to get through the world. But the navigational self, we see it as really a tool that we bring forth, a way of kind of really a useful tool, a way of being in the world. Just like if we were going to go out and it's raining out, we put on a rain jacket. If it's sunny, we put on sunscreen. We know we have that kind of, you know, clearness of what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. But we don't keep that rain jacket on all the time when we go to sleep, or we, you know, whatever we're doing, we have to have a rain jacket on. That's where we get confused about the navigational self. We see it as the self. We forget the tool, we mistake the tool for what we really are. And so the perspective of the absolute self, we see there's this emptiness. And that really the beautiful benefit of just how to live in life is the less we're identified, the more easily we're able to kind of almost call up or load up, if you will, the right navigational self. Okay, I'm dealing with my 18-year-old daughter. There's a different way that comes up. I'm dealing with a friend or with a student or, you know, a stranger. There's different ways that comes up. And because it's kind of being, the deeper perspective is the absolute self, I'm able to be very spontaneous and able to say, okay, that's not fitting. I'm going to release that. I'm going into my critical dad mode instead of my compassionate dad mode. And I'm able to hear that and be able to hear feedback. So there's kind of this way of being very flexible, very aligned with life and able to abandon it. The more stiff I am, I can't adapt so well. Right. And so then, because their absolute self, or the understanding of the absolute nature of self, the emptiness of self, that's what's the underpinning of everything. So things arise and they pass away. The self is a relative condition and it will pass away because of that relative condition. But I'm oriented towards something that's not changing, what Buddha called the deathless, that you know, sort of that birth and death of self is what is that permeating. And so that's how I address that first question. The second question around those fracturing parts of us, that's really the work of trying to understand the absolute self, right? Because that when those things are splintered away, when there's things which we say are the things I like about myself, I don't like, the things I allow, I don't allow, that's all what's going to create that sense of separation. That's going to move us away from that absolute self. So practice, you know, particularly the way that, you know, Rodney taught and I practice and teach, is that sense of turning toward that splintering. That's what I meant by that edge, working on that edge. Because like, okay, you know, someone said something and I feel that prick of anger or that hurt. Okay, let me turn toward that. You know, there's a part of me that I'm so ashamed of. I disallowed. Let me turn toward that. Let me understand. Let me learn to love it. Let me learn to bring a quality of compassion to it. So then that splintering starts to heal itself. So when we allow everything in, we allow all aspects of ourselves in equally, then there's really the absolute nature of self starts to come up more and more.
Thank you. That's really helpful.
You're very welcome. Sorry, I'm trying to mute and unmute so I don't we don't have the echo. Thank you, Amber, for that question. That was a nice way to explore some of this. All right, so let's go back here in the room and see if there's anyone. All right, Deb.
Well, catching the axe. It's often in the morning that I'm sitting and saying to myself, when am I going to become a smarter Buddhist? When is this going to happen? When am I going to remember the list? When am I going to do this? When am I going to read? When am I going to, you know, just get some traction here? Because it feels often like I sit and then, oh, the time is up, and what happened? So there's a lot of judgmentalness certainly going on, a lot of criticism. But isn't it also the case that one could devote a little more time, maybe to one's practice, and read a little bit and do this and do that? And that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing either. So I think that there's sort of a middle ground, maybe. I mean, I don't want to enter a monastery. But if I'm only just sitting and then 30 minutes go by and it's okay, I'm done now, and I go on with the rest of my day, I sometimes wonder, well, what's this about? You know, just kind of logging hours? It's not so smart. So I know that sounds judgmental. I can hear it even as I'm speaking, but maybe I'm just in a fallow period right now too with my practice. I'm not sure.
All right. Okay, excuse me while I mess with this for a second. There we go. Okay, so that has a lot of elements there, Deb, we can explore. So one hand, you talked about you want to be a smarter Buddhist, right? So, and you talked about doing more Dharma study. And then you also kind of talked about, well, is that better than just meditating, or is that kind of a juncture? So that's kind of one piece there. The other piece, like you say, you sit for 30 minutes and the time goes by and you just go on with your day. And it feels like life and meditation seem a little separate from each other. Yes, sometimes, yeah. And then maybe this is just a period of kind of that fallowness or that kind of resting between things, which, yeah, we all go through those periods. So let me just talk around that and see if we kind of get to some of the things which are helpful. So one piece around studying, it really depends on, probably the bigger question is what brings you engaged to your practice. For some people, opening up the suttas and really studying it or learning about the list is very helpful. That actually really one it becomes really engaging. Like for my own practice, Roddy didn't talk very much, how should I say it, traditionally. He didn't like go through a lot of the real traditional teachings. He kind of used kind of his own interpretation and also really his own application of those. And so it was really much pointed toward practicing and seeing for yourself, learning to cultivate that. And so when I started to study, it's like it was really a nice way because I came from the practice side first. And the study, I could see, oh, I can recognize that from my own practice, my own experience. And so it was really an enriching thing. So that's one way people can go. Sometimes people find that they study first and then that kind of really encourages them. Sometimes the study, though, can be a little bit of it can take you away from the direct experience. The direct experience of seeing for yourself the nature of the teachings. Because they all are meant to be seen, not as an abstract thing, but actually seeing how they show up right here in your mind, right here in your heart, right here in your conversation with your husband, in this or that you're doing. So they're meant to really show up in a very alive way. So the question is, how do you bring that energy up? So what I would say is probably a good way to, and part of what I'm hearing from you is that your practice feels a little directionless right now. You're not quite sure which direction to go. So the good news is there's lots of directions. The bad news is there's lots of directions, right? So I would reflect and see, okay, what part of the Dharma kind of brings you alive a little bit? You kind of, your ears perk up a little bit and see if you can start to, bring that into a kind of an active inquiry, not only to your meditation practice, but also into your life and how you go through most of your day. Does that make sense? Do you want more help around that?
Perhaps not right at the
moment. Put her on the spot. What's the most burning thing in the Dharma for you? I'm just... So it's a good time to talk to a teacher or someone who's more experienced to kind of get some input about that to help find where that is. Because we do often find, the ox is, it's gone. It's in that ravine. It's up above the mist. We don't know where it is. We don't have access to it. It's natural in our practice that we'll cycle through that. Even practicing for decades, we have those times arise. And so how do we rediscover that? What's interesting? What brings that level of aliveness? And there's many ways we can elicit that. We can investigate, contemplate your own mortality. You can contemplate suffering. You can contemplate the release of suffering. There's many ways. So hopefully that's helpful, Deb. I'm sure that speaks to many people. All right. Anyone online who'd like to share or ask anything? All right, Susan.
Thank you so much, Tim, and everyone who has shared. I sometimes need to hear something in a different language, different words to kind of tickle something inside of me. And so the what came to mind was don't know mind, perhaps leaning in the direction of the edge of known and unknown that comes to mind, because I've recently seen how many assumptions, and that word resonates with me, over stories that I make up, you know, walking down the street, seeing a horse that I'm sure there's neglect and cruelty involved because it's, you know, it looks like it's starving to death. And my mind just goes, chink, 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 chink. I know. And I'm wondering if you could speak to the don't know mind as a way of catching, you know, the ox and leading it to leading it out of delusion. Thanks.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Susan. That's a nice question around, in some ways we can talk about it being around papancha and around projection and all the way we create a sense of story around life, and we're relating to the story of what we make instead of actually what life is. And that is a nice application of trying to catch the ox, trying to find where that ox is. Because the ox isn't in our story, it's really right in that nitty-gritty. So what I found helpful, you know, around that, it's a kind of a multi-prong approach, is, you know, first to start to notice the very fact of making a story about something. To start to say, so you kind of, it's part of you needs to step back, really the mindful part, the wise part steps back a little bit and kind of observe the mind doing its thing. Okay, there's the horse with all its neglect, and you're stepping back and you're observing, oh, there's the mind doing that. And that, you know, you're already doing that. You're seeing that, right? So that's the kind of a first critical piece there. Because if not, we're just enmeshed in that story. There's no separation. There's no distance. You know, we can wake up years later having lived, you know, lived in this fantasy. This, and sometimes it's not a fantasy, right? Sometimes it's a nightmare. And so once you kind of recognize that, then step back a little bit more and notice, okay, what's kind of the, I like to look at what the emotional element that's driving that. Because often that's kind of, the thoughts kind of keep it churning. They have a strong relationship to emotion, but the emotion is often not fully acknowledged. And you go back and say, oh, I just feel really sad about this horse, or I feel angry about it. And so you kind of touch into the more, you know, almost pre-verbal quality to that emotion. So, you know, we're kind of blending psychology and all that stuff, but we're trying to see what's kind of what's churning those whole thought processes. And the trick, the big trick, is to be able to observe without judgment itself. To observe, okay, there's my mind going off, making a story. Observe, there's the deeper emotion without any self-judgment around it. That allows us, without that, releasing that, we're able to see much more clearly, more directly what's there. Okay, so we'll kind of take, just to review what we've done so far, is we've seen the story, we've learned to step back, observe the process, observe those deeper currents of emotion around it, and not judge any of that, just to observe it. Really true mindfulness, right? And then we start to say, okay, there's the story. It's almost like we slip underneath the story to the actual thing itself. Okay? And they practice this in easy ways. You hear, like right here, I can hear I-5 going by. And sometimes you hear louder trucks and louder things, and maybe there's reactions come up about that. Once if I let go of the story, you know, there's a plane. Okay, I think, oh, the plane's going this direction and da-da-da. Once if I just relax the idea plane and listen to the actual sound itself. Okay, so I'm redirecting my attention to the direct experience. Okay, so with like your horse analogy or example, you're actually looking at the image of the horse itself instead of the ideas that get generated. But I think by doing it this way, you don't try to jump over the fact that your mind's doing that. You actually see it, you explore it. You know that you're thinking, you're making a story. In other words, you're seeing the delusion, the expression of your delusion. You're seeing how your mind is painting a picture. And the more you recognize that and see that, you can start to recognize it in other ways. And you start to recognize it sooner. It's like, oh, I see someone, I just kind of plop this whole story on them. And I start to see that sooner and sooner. And I'm able to release it sooner and sooner. Like with Amber's question, I start to allow that understanding of that separation, the pain, that you start to see all that, the reasons why I paint that image on the person, the idea around the person, around myself. We do it equally to ourselves. And then that's where the unknown starts to come up, is the wisdom, or that really the mystery beyond words, beyond concepts. And when we start to do that, we start to see there's this aliveness that comes forth from that. There's this, wow, suddenly I'm relating to this actual person. I'm actually relating to this thing or this image or this sensation without all of this clutter. And that can sometimes be very touching, to say the least. It can really, the heart starts to relax and starts to open. That's seeing the ox. It's actually probably more, a little further down even. You're starting to see the ox. You're starting to relax into the ox itself.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Susan. All right, so we have maybe time for one more before we have some announcements. Anyone here in the room like to share anything? Yes, come on up, if you don't mind.
Do I hold it like this? Is that right?
Yes, you can hear okay.
I've just been dealing with this huge sense of overwhelm, inside and outside. Just too many things going on in the world that feel impossible to deal with. So, like, I turn off my radio, I close my newspaper. And also that sense of just too many things that, like, it's a pile of books on my tables, you know, unread, and, you know, things I intend to do. I'm not sure how that connects to practice. I think it's generating a whole lot of doubt and resistance. So my response to this picture, was the huge, strong, active, struggling ox and this little tiny person with the rope. And I'm thinking, if I was that little guy, I'd just let the rope go and let the ox wander down into the ravine. And so this picture, I mean, it was very different from my response last week with the glimpse. This is like, do I really want to grab that ox and try to tame that thing? I mean, it feels very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, these pictures and these verses will bring up, you know, each person has their own relationship to them, and it's really nice to hear people's different understanding, because it does meet that, and there is the, yeah, that's a very, very reasonable thing to let go of that big ox, and, you know, yet this person has this deep hunger for the ox, for really catching the ox and really taming it, and really that hunger for that sense of who we are, to really see that. And so that's kind of going back to Deb's question, is, you know, where is, you know, can that hunger, sometimes we have access to it, sometimes we just can't stop it, and sometimes it seems so far away. And that's, the more you have access to that, the more the practice starts to come alive for you. So that's just to kind of float that out there. Like, periodically, like, ask, well, why do I practice? Why do I put all this effort into this? Another way to say it, you know, like talking about all the things in the world and all the things you want to, you know, the big pile of things you haven't got to. Another way of asking is, what's really the most important in my life? You know, whether it's Dharma practice or something else, and letting that start to kind of reveal itself. And start to say, okay, these things, you know, at some point they were important to me and now they're not. But this thread, I want to keep holding on to that. Like that William Stafford poem, there's a thread that we feel, that we hold on to. We go through all kinds of different changes, but we keep that thread. Yeah. But it's really an alive question. So I appreciate you practicing with that and bringing that forth. All right. So let's pause with the questions. And again, next week, Chwari will be here teaching on this verse and this image. We just have a few announcements.